Hey, y'all. It's the NPR Politics Podcast. We are here today to talk about President Obama's State of the Union address Tuesday night. This was his seventh and also his last. I'm Sam Sanders, campaign reporter for NPR.
I'm Mara Liasson, national political correspondent.
And I'm Susan Davis, and I cover Congress.
All right, so here is how it all started.
Tonight marks the eighth year that I've come here to report on the State of the Union. And for this final one, I'm going to try to make it a little shorter. I know some of you are antsy to get back to Iowa.
So that joke kind of set the tone for the whole speech, right? It was really influenced a lot by this big, intense campaign for president that we are in the midst of right now.
Absolutely. And I think the White House kind of missold the speech when they said it was going to be future-oriented, not a laundry list. It was going to be about big themes. It was about big themes, but it was mostly a point-by-point rebuttal of what you are hearing on the presidential campaign from Republicans. And it was a defense of his approach and his agenda and the way he sees the big problems of the country as opposed to what you're hearing from them.
So what are those points?
Oh, well, the biggest rebuttal was the gloom and doom that you hear from Republicans about how America is in decline, weak abroad, the economy is terrible. Mm-hmm. And he very, very forcefully said, that's just hooey.
Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction.
So he said the American economy is the most robust in the world. We've got these prolonged period of job growth. The auto industry has come roaring back. However, he knows that Americans are not as bullish on the economy as he is. He knows that two-thirds of them tell pollsters that they think the country's on the wrong track, and they know, and he knows that he gets poor marks for his job approval. So he was very careful to explain that he understood how Americans were feeling, and he gave them an explanation of why they're feeling that way.
And the reason that a lot of Americans feel anxious is that the economy has been changing in profound ways. Changes that started long before the Great Recession hit. Changes that have not let up.
Changes like what?
He talked about technology and globalization and how that makes it harder for workers to ask for a raise. It means that more and more jobs are being replaced by robots. It means that corporations have less and less loyalty to their communities.
And more wealth and income is concentrated at the very top.
So one of the things I think is interesting is when I listen to State of the Unions, and I have to admit that this is the 14th consecutive State of the Union that I've covered.
I'm so sorry.
I've lost count.
Tamara's probably covered more than me, but I've covered everyone since 2003. And for all but one of those 14, I've been in the chamber. So I always think of it, I look at it, especially as covering Congress, I try and listen to it with two ears. I listen to it with one ear as being a Republican and one ear as being a Democrat. And what do the members in this room take? And I think these were two very different speeches.
Also,
in one sense, if you listen to it as he was talking to Democrats, I think it gave them a reminder of all the reasons why they fell in love with Obama in the first place. The loftiness of it, especially towards the end when he talked about the American idea and compassion and moving forward and these and the thematic ways that Obama speaks that drew Democrats to him in the first place. And then if you listen to it with Republican ears, it reminds you of the reasons why there has been so much clash and so much partisanship. And I think, as Mara alluded to, there was this sort of point-by-point
response
to a lot of the charges that I think Republicans have made against the president.
Which response was the spiciest to you?
I would say in the current debate, when he talked about ISIS, the Islamic State, and the threat they pose, was really counter to the rhetoric that we hear from Republicans.
As we focus on destroying ISIS, over-the-top claims that this is World War III just play into their hands. Masses of fighters on the back of pickup trucks, twisted souls plotting in apartments or garages, they pose an enormous danger to civilians. They have to be stopped. But they do not threaten our national existence.
When I heard that line, all I could think was, what is going on in the minds of senators like John McCain and Lindsey Graham right now, who have been two of the most vocal and forceful counterpoints on the Islamic State, saying that they are an incredibly important existential threat and need to be taken more seriously.
But what does this mean to a civilian listening? Right. Because on the first part of that graph, he's saying, oh, it's just a bunch of guys in pickup trucks. But then he goes on to say they pose an enormous danger to civilians. Civilians are the ones that are watching this speech.
Well, the civilians, here's what he did. This was a really interesting paragraph to me. For people who really are tuned in, they know that Chris Christie said we are in the next world war.
Yeah.
So he was pushing back against Chris Christie without naming him. However, he also knows that he has gotten into a lot of trouble and he's been out of sync with the American people when he tries to poo-poo ISIS or say they're just the JV team. So he says they pose an enormous danger to civilians, but they're not an existential threat. And I think even John McCain and Lindsey Graham wouldn't say that they can wipe out America. They're not a threat to our national existence, but they are a big threat. And that's why he spent quite a bit of time in this speech talking about what he was doing, why the strategy was right. And also, he even defended himself against this perennial criticism that he refuses to call ISIL Islamic terrorism. Radical Islamic terrorism.
We sure don't need to push away vital allies in this fight by echoing the lie that ISIL is somehow representative of one of the world's largest religions.
And he goes on to say that what they are, let's call them what they are, killers, fanatics who need to be wiped out.
And he also goes on to kind of take some subtle jabs, I think, at some GOP candidates like Ted Cruz and Donald Trump when he says, you know,
our answer needs to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. That may work as a TV soundbite, but it doesn't pass muster on the world stage.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I took away from it, too, is it's very clear from this speech that President Obama has been paying attention to the Republican presidential field and the debates and the rhetoric, and that it was interesting to me that he used this platform as a way to respond to them. On Trump, reading between his lines here, when he talked about tone, when he talked about the way religious tolerance, obviously referring to Trump's comments on stopping Muslims from entering the country, he also made reference to Ted Cruz made a comment about lighting up the sand in the Middle East and bombing in the Middle East.
Carpet
and he said,
bombing.
We can't carpet bomb our way out of this, using his words directly. So clearly, responding directly without naming them to the rhetoric of the Republicans on foreign policy and essentially saying how wrong he thinks they are.
Does this work?
Look, he has a huge, this is the bully pulpit. If you want to know what the bully pulpit is, this is it. And we don't know if it's going to work, but he had an opportunity to provide a counter narrative. And up until now, the Republican candidates were more or less operating in a vacuum. And he joined the debate with them.
And in some ways, you know, this is Obama's closing argument. This is his last State of the Union. It's one of the last times this year he's going to address the entire nation plan that we know of. He'll probably speak at the convention. Probably.
This
but we
is
don't
the
know
biggest
sure.
speech most Americans will ever hear.
But
the
this
last
is it.
Big speech.
So this was his, you know, you swing for the fences on this one. And another thing that I would
say. Did he hit the fences?
Well, the other thing that I would say about that I thought was striking to me about this speech that was different than other State of the Unions is that it was kind of unambitious when it comes to policy.
Yes.
You know, and
like he really gave no policy specifics.
Yeah, this was more about bigger themes, bigger ideas. This wasn't about a legislative to-do list for the year ahead.
And was that, you know, there was all this ramp up before the speech of his team saying it's going to be a different speech. It's going to be so different. Was that the difference that he was speaking
that
of?
That was one of the
that
biggest
one of
ones.
Them, yeah.
And quite frankly, it makes perfect sense. He can't get anything big through Congress. He did talk about big things. He talked about the big things that he wants. What he didn't say is here's the legislative vehicle that I want Congress to work on.
Like by the extent of the hype I was hearing, I was waiting for like something
you were waiting for Boston
different.
2004. You were waiting for
a legislative vehicle. I was waiting for backup dance. I was waiting for like a musical cameo.
Well,
like,
or
there
you
was
were just,
so much roll up to this,
I really,
right?
That's why I was saying they missold it. They pointed us
they
in the direction
it.
That it was going to be
it.
Something really different. What they meant, the most honest thing they said in the previews was it's not going to be a laundry list of policy
there you go.
Proposals.
Yeah. That
was
just say
correct.
That. Don't like tell yes. me it's going to be, you know, a freaking Beyonce concert.
There was something, and maybe Mara can help me find the word that I'm looking for here. And I don't, flippant is not the word. That is not the word. But there was something about the president that I thought was also, there was some humor in him when he opened up and said, I know some of you need to get back to Iowa. Well, in the speech when he said, you know, when Sputnik, we didn't debate that it was up there. Yeah. Like he had sort of an
it felt like the whole time he was silently saying, well, duh, you guys don't get this. You guys don't know this.
This is what drives Republicans.
Yes.
Nuts. You know what it's
like? And that's
like?
Why I'm trying to get this word.
It's the cool mocking humor.
Yes.
They don't like that.
But even though, I mean, it felt like that kid in like ninth grade Algebra 2 who finishes all the problems first and is just like, oh, well, you just got to cross, multiply, and divide. You don't know that?
That walks up and puts his paper on the teacher's desk and walks out the door. It was a little bit of that.
I could see how folks would not like that.
Yeah. He was a little like, and I think that this one I say when I was listening to the speech, if I was listening to it with Republican ears as a Republican congressman, there was a lot in there that I thought was really provocative towards them.
Yeah.
The line where he also says, where, you know, we're going back here. He's going back to Dodd-Frank and financial reform and the financial crisis when he says, hey, food stamp recipients didn't cause the financial collapse. Immigrants are not the reason why your paycheck hasn't gone up. I mean, things like that to a Republican congressman ear is very provocative. His comments on climate change.
If anybody still wants to dispute the science around climate change, have at it. You will be pretty lonely because you'll be debating our military, most of America's business leaders, the majority of the American people, almost the entire scientific community, and 200 nations around the world who agree it's a problem and intend to solve it. But,
yeah.
I mean, there was a little bit of, like, pat on the head
oh, yeah.
towards Republicans oh, yeah. in the speech that I thought was what made it, to my ears, a very political speech. I mean,
it was very partisan
in that regard.
And why wouldn't it be?
Right.
You know, Rand Paul tweeted something to the effect that, I'm here at home watching, and I just yelled, "You lie!" It's a good thing I'm not in the chamber.
but
he didn't try to convince people that climate change is real. He said, "This is settled. The country has moved on," and he is with majority opinion on a lot of these things. Majority Republican opinion is on the other side.
Now, there was one moment where he kind of got a little bit reflective and admitted that he might have messed up himself, too. He's talked about one of the regrets of his presidency.
It's one of the few regrets of my presidency, that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. I have no doubt a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office.
Does that count as humble bragging or not?
He's basically saying, oh, well, I'm not Lincoln or Roosevelt.
But I'm close. This is a debate that, depending on who you talk to, is a debate that, I mean, that lights up everybody of who is to blame for the coarseness and the grading of our politics. And if you talk to Democrats, they say they put a lot of blame on not necessarily Republicans, but talk radio, Republican media. A lot of that has been driven in the Obama era. Republicans will say that they believe that the president has been arrogant, that he has mishandled Congress, that he's gone too far and has inflamed tensions when he could have calmed them down. But referencing that at least acknowledges that this has been one of the great debates of the Obama era. Who is to blame for the negative and the increasing nastiness in American politics.
But also, he came into office wanting to bridge the divide, and he thought he would be a unifying figure.
In fact, he was seen as a unifying figure.
Yes, originally he was. But you know,
for three months.
But the other thing that's important, and I think this gets glossed over a little bit, he spent a lot of time very specifically and substantively talking about why our politics is broken. He talked about gerrymandering. He talked about campaign finance reform. He talked about how members of Congress on both sides tell him privately they don't like spending all this time raising money.
Yeah.
They're sick of it. So, and now that is a very big Democratic Party issue. Don't kid yourself. That was a big chunk of speech time directed at the Democratic base.
And voting rights.
Yeah. And that's a very big issue for them. But he did talk in substance about the kinds of forces that make politics broken, not just what he could have done to bridge the divide.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the visuals for 1 second, and then we'll jump on. There's always the faces of the people who are just not excited to be there. I noticed a lot Paul Ryan. I noticed the face of Mr. Lindsey Graham, I noticed the face. Who else had some weird face? I think Marco Rubio had a
also, in some ways, I feel like it's hard on them because if you are Paul Ryan or Marco Rubio, maybe Lindsey Graham was more surprised, but Marco Rubio had to know going in there that the cameras are going to be on him because he's running for president. So
yeah. And he was the only one. Ted Cruz was in New Hampshire.
Bernie Sanders was in there.
Oh, that's
Bernie looked a little out of it, too.
They showed Bernie, too.
Yeah, but that, he has an easier job when you're of the same party.
It's probably hard to maintain a, like, polite, active listening face for an hour when you know cameras are trying to get that moment.
I wanted to know what the side chatter was between Biden and Paul Ryan. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think with Joe Biden, you know, I hung out in the chamber after the speech. The lights turn off. You know, it was over. And Joe Biden stayed on the floor of the House for probably 15 or 20 more minutes after Obama left, just talking to members, getting pictures with them, you know, hugging them.
It's also his last ride, too.
Yeah, you know, and I would say this about Joe Biden. He is probably one of the most universally liked figures still in politics, and that Paul Ryan and him, I think, have a very good relationship. I would also say they are both Irishmen, and Irishmen are good at getting along and making conversation.
And, you know, Paul Ryan, when I watched Paul Ryan, and he, of course, was the one who was the most watched because he was behind the president and he was going to be on camera all night long.
Yeah.
I felt he had chosen the smile. He had chosen what he thought was kind of a neutral,
polite,
not too enthusiastic, polite smile. It's a hard job.
It is a hard
job. To sit there and compose your face when you really want to talk back to the president.
Another hard job is the response to this speech.
Yeah.
Nikki Haley, governor of South Carolina, gave it last night. How do we think she did?
It had a mixed reception among Republicans. The two main things she did that really jumped out after she did the quick summary of all of Obama's failings, which is kind of
that's what you do
pro forma, she said that Republicans have to take responsibility themselves for broken politics.
We as Republicans need to own that truth. We need to recognize our contributions to the erosion of the public trust in America's leadership. We need to accept that we've played a role in how and why our government is broken.
And the other thing she did was to push back against Donald Trump.
During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation. No one who is willing to work hard, abide by our laws, and love our traditions should ever feel unwelcome in this country.
Hmm. And what's interesting is she went on to say, of course we should stop illegal immigration, and of course we should stop refugees coming into the country if we cannot discern their intent. However, this is what is the bite that jumped out at everybody, and she's on the short list of the among the chattering class for who might be on the ticket.
Someone campaigning for the general election.
Except wait a minute. That sounded like somebody who wants a spot on the ticket but not on the Trump ticket.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. It's also interesting because so who picks the response? It's the speaker and the majority leader are the two that get to decide who does it. So the sort of underlying tone that I thought was really interesting is it's a reminder that there are forces within the party who don't necessarily want to call out Donald Trump by name, but are very actively trying to counter the message that he's put out as a leading contender in the presidential race, that this is not what the Republican Party stands for. This is not what the Republican Party is.
One tweet that I really liked yesterday, I think it was Jonathan Martin of The New York Times. Forgive me if I get it wrong. It was a reminder that there are three parties in American politics right now.
There's
the two parties inside the Republican Party, the establishment, and what we want to call the Trumpians, and then the Democrats.
Speaking of Trump, he did tweet one response. At first, I was like, why isn't Trump tweeting? What's going on? Then he finally did tweet, and he wrote, "The Sotu speech is really boring, slow, lethargic, very hard to watch." That was his response. Anyway, overall, what do we think these speeches change, if anything?
Well, from the perspective of what does it mean with what they're going to get done this year, I think it changes very little. And the things that the president acknowledged in his speech were the things that already have been talked about in the orbit of what's possible this year. One, there's still some talk about doing criminal justice reform. That's still on the table, although it's hard. A sentencing reform.
Yeah.
And there's a strange bipartisan mix of lawmakers who want to get this done. The president likes it. It's possible. It's not a sure thing, but there's going to be some efforts. He did mention last night a trade deal he'd really like to get done before he leaves office, perhaps some minor legislation here and there. But like I said, it was not a very ambitious policy speech. It wasn't about, wow, look at all the stuff we can get done before I leave. It was more about, I think, closing arguments and setting the stage for the elections this year.
Yeah, and the year before an election is a very inauspicious time to get legislation through. However, there have been examples, and 1996 was one of them, when if one party feels that it's not going to win the White House and it does have control of Congress, it has a real interest in working with the president to beef up their own list of accomplishments. So we'll see. Yeah. There are surprising things that can get done. I mean, No Child Left Behind. That was a surprise. It got
the Affordable Care Act happened in an election year. Well, it wasn't a presidential election year,
and it wasn't bipartisan.
Yeah.
And anything that happens this time has to be bipartisan.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Do we know anything yet about how the public received these two speeches?
I haven't seen polls. All I've heard is the instant dial groups that some networks have, and that it was received very well. And as a matter of fact, CNN said it was the most positive reception for those kinds of dial groups of any of his State of the Unions. But I think we'll see more in the days to come.
And it's probably safe to say that the speech probably didn't change any minds, right? That this was not the point of the speech. If you turned into the State of the Union supporting Barack Obama, you probably woke up this morning still supporting Barack Obama. And the opposite is true. Yes. If this is a president you've opposed for 8 years, that's you woke up opposing Barack Obama today as well.
But what the White House was hoping was that if you were one of those people who supported him, you're feeling a little more excited and energized now than you were before he spoke. And maybe you're going to tune into the Democratic primary campaign, or maybe you're going to answer that email from the Hillary people, something like that.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this one. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with our usual roundup of political news later in the week, including Thursday night's GOP debate. Until then, let us know if you like the show. Find us on Twitter and catch our political coverage on your local public radio station as well. I'm Sam Sanders, campaign reporter.
I'm Mara Liasson, national political correspondent.
And I'm Susan Davis, and I cover Congress.
And we'll see you next time on the NPR Politics Podcast.